فلسطين صوت الشعب الفلسطيني من فانكوفر.
This is the voice of Palestine, the voice of the Palestinian people, coming to you from Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of The Voice of Palestine. It's April 27th and I'm your host, Hanna Qawwas. Our feature tonight is an interview with Rabia Al-Masri from Montreal, a leading activist in the campaign to halt the deportation of Palestinian refugees from Canada. We'll also have our music selections and focus on Zionism. Tonight we are part of Co-op Radio's Spring Marathon, where we ask our listeners to call in and pledge their support for the Voice of Palestine and the station. Please phone 684-8494. That's 684-8494 and renew a membership or have a new membership. Membership range from 25 to 55 for individuals. Now we'll have our news with Marion.
Good evening. Gaza. Early today, Israeli soldiers shot dead three Palestinians, two in the West Bank city of Tulkarm and a teenager in Ramallah, according to witnesses and medical sources. According to eyewitnesses, Israeli troops launched an incursion into the Tulkarm refugee camp amid intensive shooting and then imposed a tight curfew. Soldiers opened heavy gunfire at residents, killing two and wounding another. Medics at the Tabat Hospital confirmed that Ashraf Hassan, 25, and Amjad Umara, 21, were both killed after being shot in the head, and another Palestinian was also critically wounded. Meanwhile, Islam Zahran, just 14, from the city of Ramallah, also died today of wounds he had sustained on April 18th when Israeli soldiers opened fire at homes in the Abu Mashal village. And just yesterday, three more Palestinians were shot dead by Israeli troops in Gaza. April 21st, Beit Lahia, Gaza. A total of 12 Palestinians were killed in just 24 hours after the Israeli army launched a major operation in the northern Gaza Strip, according to medical sources. Eight Palestinians were shot dead by Israeli troops last Wednesday, including a 12-year-old boy, while another four were killed during the clashes in the Beit Lahia area at the start of the Israeli operation. As he ushered one of his sons away from the scene of the clashes, Abu Mohammed al-Dahour said Israeli tanks had surrounded his home in which his wife and 10 other children were still inside. "I have only been able to get away with one of my sons. I pray to God to protect the others," he said. Many of the homes in the town had been severely damaged by the shooting, while fields had been razed by army bulldozers. Tufik Abu Jarad, a 24-year-old Beit Lahia resident, said Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon wants to totally destroy the Gaza Strip before his planned withdrawal. He said, "Sharon is committing a massacre in Beit Lahia. What have the children done who they are firing on?" he asked. And the Palestinian Authority denounced the incursion as a serious escalation pointing out that it had been carried out despite Ariel Sharon's promise to withdraw from the territory. A chief advisor to Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, Nabil Abu Rudaina, told reporters, "The assassinations and serious escalations in the Israeli aggressions prove that Israel has no intention of withdrawing from Gaza as it is pretending, but rather it is trying to sabotage all the efforts to relaunch the peace process." And just this morning, six Palestinian ambulances, including one operated by the Palestinian Medical Relief Society and several operated by the Palestine Red Crescent Society, were detained at the Wadi Nar checkpoint, which lies between Al-Azariya and Bethlehem and controls all movement between the north and south regions of the West Bank. The six ambulances were held for 2 hours with entrances to the two towns blocked. Preventing the free movement of ambulances places the lives of Palestinian civilians at considerable risk. The majority of the ambulances detained at Wadi Nar were transporting patients with serious health conditions, and immediate access to a hospital was imperative. One of the ambulances was delivering three patients to Beit Jala Hospital, which is the only health care center in the West Bank that provides chemotherapy treatment. Furthermore, the Israeli soldiers prevented the medical teams from carrying out their essential humanitarian work, which completely violates all principles of medical neutrality. Whilst the teams were stuck at the checkpoints, they were therefore unable to reach other important emergency cases. The soldiers demanded that the ambulances should have special permission to pass, which is totally unacceptable, according to international law, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Fourth Geneva Convention, and international Red Cross regulations. According to all of these, emergency medical teams have the right to free movement. Earlier, just a few days ago, on April 25th, another Palestine Medical Relief Society emergency medical team was also prevented from carrying out its essential role when an ambulance carrying a patient with heart disease was prevented from passing through another Israeli checkpoint. At 6:30 in the morning in Nablus, 63-year-old Mohammed Abdul Razak, diabetic and suffering from heart disease, was referred from Nablus Hospital to Al Maqasid Hospital in Jerusalem. His condition had severely deteriorated and he required a serious cardiovascular surgical operation. On April 25th, a group of about 25 Palestinian women met at the city council in Bidu village to have a peaceful women's demonstration against the apartheid wall. They were joined by 30 Israeli and 10 international women. Five Palestinian men between the ages of 22 and 70 have been killed by the Israeli military in Bidu during peaceful demonstrations against the wall in just the last 2 months. At 11 a.m. on April 25th, the group of women marched from the city council towards the work site carrying banners such as "Bush and Sharon won't decide our fate," and chanting slogans against the apartheid wall and occupation. Israeli soldiers stopped the women on the road, preventing them from reaching their lands. The women stood about 5 meters away from the soldiers, peacefully chanting and protesting the theft of their livelihood. After 5 to 10 minutes, the Israeli military fired tear gas and sound bombs into the crowd of women. Despite being hit directly by sound bombs and shrapnel and suffering the effect of tear gas, several of the women held their ground close to the soldiers. However, within minutes, horses came down the hillside and border police approached from the side, isolating the group of women at the front. Soldiers attempted to grab Palestinian and international women and also beat some of the Israeli women with batons. One Palestinian woman, Dima from Al-Izawiya, was beaten and taken away by Israeli soldiers with three international women, Angela from France, Angie from Britain, and Huwaida from the United States. They were all arrested. Meanwhile, four soldiers on horses charged into the crowd, menacing women, following them, and beating them with batons. It is worth noting that Huwaida is the woman that we interviewed in our special feature last week, talking about the apartheid wall and the effect it was having on Palestinian people's lives and on their land and water resources. We're now going to take a short break, but just before we go to the break, we'd like to remind listeners that tonight we're part of a special 2 weeks of programming, and today is a special day of programming entitled Celebrating Resistance. All of this is part of Co-op Radio Spring Marathon, and this is one of the two times in the year that Co-op Radio appeals to the listeners and supporters to help keep the show on the air by pledging a donation or taking out a membership. You can either renew an old membership or take out a new one, or if you're able to do so, upgrade a current membership. Memberships are a main source of funding for the station, and that's what helps keep the station on the air and keeps programs like Voice of Palestine also on the air, so that we can bring you interviews from people like Huwaida, interviews on the ground who can give you a real genuine insight into what is happening on the ground in Palestine. So we're urging listeners to call in at 604-684-8494 and take out a membership, pledge your support, call now. That's 604-684-94. And now, back to the news. April 21st. Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Korea has said his cabinet is considering a mass resignation to protest against the shift in United States policy that favors Israel and violates Palestinian rights. Korea said last Wednesday this was one of several proposals being weighed in response to the U.S. assurances to Israel that it could retain West Bank settlements and that Palestinian refugees would not be returned to settle in Israel in a final peace treaty. The resignation issue is one of the issues under discussion within the Palestinian Authority and the leadership, Correa told Reuters at his office in the West Bank town of Abu Dis. Meanwhile, Palestinian Labor Minister Ghassan Al-Khatib also told reporters, "The option of dissolving the cabinet was suggested by many. Some are proposing going to the International Court to complain against George Bush. Others want the United Nations General Assembly to meet and reiterate international resolutions." That was Palestinian Labor Minister Ghassan Al-Khatib. April 27th. Anglican Bishop Abu El-Assal has offered Mordechai Vanunu unlimited sanctuary at St. George's Church Guest House in East Jerusalem. The bishop, who returned yesterday from a trip to Jordan and Lebanon, put an end to waves of speculation about Mordechai Vanunu's future residence. One report had Vanunu about to move to a larger Anglican church in Nazareth. Last night, Bishop Assel held a dinner for Vanunu to express his support for the former nuclear technician who was recently freed from an Israeli prison. In fact, Vanunu and his brother Meir have not left the grounds of St. George's Church for some days. This week, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, which is representing Vanunu, and Israeli security officials worked out procedures for examining journals and letters confiscated from Vanunu's prison cell. Under the terms of this agreement, the association's attorney, Dan Zacher, will receive a special security clearance and will be authorized to review these materials. And moving to Iraq, just today, fierce fighting has erupted around and in the Iraqi city of Fallujah as U.S. occupation forces strike the town with warplanes, helicopter gunships, mortar bombs, and tanks. Live footage shown on Al Jazeera TV showed the night sky incessantly lit up as strike after strike hit mainly the Golan district of the city. Al Jazeera's correspondent reported a heavy exchange of gunfire was also being heard and that several homes were on fire. He added that U.S. Marines were not only attacking from the air with helicopter gunships and planes, but that ground troops are using machine guns and tanks as well. "I can hear more than 10 explosions a minute. Fires are lighting the night sky," another witness told Reuters. He added, "The earth is shaking under my feet." And just a few days ago, on April 24th, three families of refugees from the besieged city of Fallujah, who are now seeking refuge in the Al Hadamiyah neighborhood of Baghdad, described the conditions in their embattled city as a horrible disaster. A man called Khalid Abu Majed, speaking from Fallujah on behalf of the Islamic Party, stated that while some relief supplies are getting inside the city, a great number of families remain trapped in their homes, and the stench of dead bodies has become overpowering. Crowded inside an empty house in the district of Baghdad, Abu Maher, patriarch of one family that left Fallujah over the weekend, told of a harrowing journey out of his home city. "We were nearly bombed by the Americans when we tried to leave on Friday," he said. "Bombs fell in front and behind us, so we had to turn back. Saturday, we were lucky to escape," he added. Estimates of total refugees vary, but most reports suggest at least 60,000 Fallujans, or about one quarter of the city's population, have already fled Fallujah for Baghdad and other major cities. Meanwhile, Abdulaziz, the 15-year-old son of Abu Maher, stated, "I saw two of my neighbors shot by U.S. snipers when I went outside one time. I also saw some of the small cluster bombs on the ground that were dropped by the warplanes. Most times, though, we were too afraid even to look out of our windows," he added. And yet another refugee angrily asked, "This is the way the Americans are freeing Iraq? America's freedom is killing Iraqis. Fallujah is becoming another Palestine. How long will we have to live like this?" the refugee questioned. And that was the news for tonight. But just before we go to our music break, we'd like to just remind listeners one more time that tonight we are part of Co-op Radio's special spring marathon, and the theme for tonight's programming actually is celebrating resistance. Hopefully we can join in the spirit of that and ask listeners to please call in and support the station, support the show. Memberships are not a huge amount of money, and they are tax deductible, and the station is mostly member supported. That's what allows us to stay independent and to be able to bring you the kind of programming that we are able to bring you. Limited income memberships are $25. Regular memberships are $50, and then there's other ones that go up from there. Family memberships or special extra memberships that people, if they feel they can take out more, can contribute to those. So we encourage you to call in now. We're going to let our music run a little bit longer than usual, give people time to call in before we go to the interview. Call in now at 604-684-8494. One more time, that number,
684-8494. يا عربي اصحى من النوم لا تظلك شبان قاتل صهيون وشالوم وتحدى العدوان اول ما تقاتل امريكا خلي الدنيا تصر شربيكا اول ما تقاتل امريكا خلي الدنيا تصر شربيكا فجرها طوفان فجرها طوفان يا عربي اصحى من النوم لا تظلك شبان قاتل صهيون وشالوم وتحدى العدوان اول ما تقاتل
فجرها طوفان دربك رح يجيك اليوم وثيابك بالحزن تقدد سباك الملخوم وتصيح في كوها الوردة مثل الماخذ حقنة شطة
وتصيح في كوها الوردة مثل الماخذ حقنة شطة
أو شارب قطران أو شارب قطران يا عربي اصحى من النوم لا تضلك جبان قادل صهيوني وشالوم وتحدى العدوان أول ما تقاتل أمريكا خلي الدنيا تصير شربيكا
يا ويلي يا ويلي يا بقيت حيام خدار بصيح الصوت عليك الله أكبر هل وين النخوة وين أهل الغيارة وثلثين شعبك يا أقصى لا تكسر يا باي يا 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 باي يا شعب الحر الدائر في فلسطين كسر فتح المحاجر للصهاين يا شعب الحر الدائر في فلسطين كسر فتح المحاجر للصهاين
And we were listening to Abu Firas, a Palestinian singer, O Arab, wake up and fight. You're listening to the Voice of Palestine. With us live tonight on the phone from Montreal is Rabia Al-Masri, an activist with the Committee to Defend Palestinian Refugees in Canada. Good evening, Rabia, and welcome to the Voice of Palestine.
Thank you very much.
Could you please give our listeners some background about the struggle of the Palestinian refugees in Canada? And if you could tell us why the Canadian government is not accepting many after September 11?
Well, about 3 years ago, there is a good number of Palestinian refugees that came to Canada. Several hundred Palestinian refugees, the great majority of them coming from the refugee camps in Lebanon, came to Canada through the United States and claimed refugee status in Canada. As some of the listeners might know, the conditions in the refugee camps in Lebanon are extremely harsh and have kept deteriorating from year to year for the past several decades. And there are many restrictions that are placed on Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, such as not being allowed to work in over 70 professions, not being allowed to own property, not being allowed to travel freely. You know, a lot of the refugee camps in the south of Lebanon have checkpoints that restricts the movement of people in and out of the refugee camps. People are not allowed to enter construction material inside the refugee camp to renovate their homes. And very often these are homes that have been bombed and shelled during the 16-year civil war in Lebanon. So the conditions are extremely hard, and there is no life to be had. There is no life to have there in Lebanon for most Palestinian refugees. So a lot of the young men generally, without exception, are trying to flee these conditions as they feel left out from any political process, and they see no future whatsoever. As soon as they're born Palestinian in Lebanon, they have absolutely no rights. So most of these young men had no choice, you know, saw that they had no choice but to flee. And they were able to come to Canada. That was about 3 years ago. It's quite rare for Palestinian refugees from Lebanon to be able to make it through such a long distance and, you know, reach North America. So to most of the Palestinian refugees, they thought that once they reached the Canadian borders and applied for refugee status, that that would be, you know, the end of their suffering and the start of a new life, you know, where they can live in dignity with all the basic rights that most of people here take for granted. Unfortunately, what happened is that they had to go through the refugee determination process in Canada, which after 9/11 has been restricted in several ways. You know, new regulations that passed basically make it that there's only one commissioner, one judge that takes the decision whether to accept the refugee claim or not. Mm-hmm. And once that decision is taken, there's absolutely no recourse on the merit of the case itself. There is no appeal process. Mm-hmm. There's a few bureaucratic procedures that people follow. And in over 97% of the cases, these bureaucratic procedures do not overturn the decision of these commissioners. So prior to September 11th, there were two commissioners that took the decision. And one out of two decisions, if one out of the two decisions was positive, then the decision, the final decision rendered would be positive. Mm-hmm. So what happened is that, you know, a lot of the Palestinian refugees were confronted by biased commissioners, ignorant commissioners, you know, noting that these commissioners are, by the way, political nominated, not, they're politically nominated. They're not people who necessarily have any kind of background related to the refugee determination process or to the Palestinian issue or any other political or, you know, social issue related to the refugee determination process. So, you know, they were rejected after that, and they had no recourse. So now, you know, a large number of these Palestinian refugees are now facing deportation from Canada back to refugee camps in Lebanon, and some back to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, back to the military the deadly and illegal Israeli military occupation of Palestine.
Yeah, actually, we received today just an alert about Osama Saleh, and you're calling for a demo in his support. He's going to be deported. Could you give us a bit of background about Osama? And there is another person who was scheduled to be deported the end of this month. And do they have any legal course, or that's the end of the appeal process?
Well, like I said before, there's a good number of Palestinian refugees that are facing deportation. And there's already 15 deportations that have taken place since we started this campaign about a year ago. Mm-hmm. You know, people who've been deported mainly back to the refugee camps in Lebanon. This month, we saw the two first cases that we are directly involved in of Palestinian refugees that have come from the occupied territories, from occupied Palestine, mm-hmm. and who are now facing deportation. So pretty much once you receive the date of deportation, you really don't have recourse left. You know, two things that might happen in order to stop that deportation are, you know, a decision taken administratively by the Minister of Citizenship and by Citizenship and Immigration, who is Judy Sproul, or there's a last recourse, which is to go in front of the federal court and ask for a stay of deportation. So the hearing for Osama Saleh is going to be tomorrow in front of the federal court, and his deportation date is set for Thursday morning. He's supposed to be deported. Now, Osama is from Tulkarm in the West Bank, and you know, Osama is a young Palestinian who had to endure the suffering that most young people in Palestine, you know, continue to endure on a daily basis. And he's a person who, like many other young Palestinians, during the first Intifada, was active in the popular uprising and was detained and tortured by the Israeli army. And then he was able to, he actually left Palestine for a while because he was able to secure a job in the United Arab Emirates. You know, but once his visa expired, he had to go back to the West Bank a few days before the second Intifada. And, you know, even during the second Intifada, he had to endure basically what people are enduring every day there, which are, you know, killings, daily assassinations, you know, thousands of people injured every day, you know, since the beginning of the Intifada, thousands of young men and even women and children detained and tortured, you know, the expropriation of land, the building of the apartheid wall that's separating families from one another, homes from one another, people from their villages, from their towns, from their hospitals, from their schools. You know, and in the area where Osama lives, he lives in the outskirts of Tulkarm, in a village area which is, you know, at the border of an Israeli settlement. So very often what happened in his areas is a lot of the Israeli settlers would come down to his neighborhood and try to expropriate part of the land by simply settling in it.
Yeah.
And this has been ongoing for several years in their neighborhood. And just recently, while he has been in Canada, the Israeli soldiers, you know, are protecting these settlers, have raided the house of his family and have harassed and beaten his parents, who are over 7 years old. So this is part of the reality that Osama, you know, tried to escape. And now Canada is deporting him back to this deadly military occupation. So it's quite amazing, and it's shocking, and it's it's disheartening to see that this is happening.
Yeah.
Because on one end, you have foreign affairs in Canada that's recognizing the danger that exists in the West Bank. There's a travel advisory on the Foreign Affairs website that asks all Canadian citizens who are in the West Bank to leave immediately. And it even states that they might find it difficult to leave due to checkpoints and curfews that are placed by the Israeli authorities. So on one hand, Canada is recognizing that there is extreme danger there and asking its own citizens to flee. But on the other hand, through its immigration department, it's deporting people back to the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And this shows a clear contradiction where, you know, there's more value that's given to a life of a Canadian than given to a Palestinian who's probably much more at risk.
Yeah.
No one sent back to the West Bank.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the Canadian position later, but before that, could you tell us about the 9 Palestinians who are living underground in Montreal, of which 3 elderly Palestinians who have taken refuge in a Montreal church? What's happening to them, and what's the update on their situation?
Well, as I explained earlier, due to the conditions in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the conditions in the refugee camps in Lebanon, some of the failed refugee claimants, once they receive their deportation orders, take the difficult decision to not respect that deportation order, and they stay in Canada living underground.
Mm-hmm.
So there is right now 9 Palestinians who are living underground. Of these 9 Palestinians, there is 3 people. It's a family that has taken refuge in a church here in Montreal, Notre Dame de Grâce Church, and they've been in that church for more than 3 months now.
Yeah.
What this basically means is that they cannot leave the church. They've been inside that church for all this period, and they're going to stay inside until hopefully their case is solved. And the family that's in the church is a family from the refugee camp of Ain El Helwe in the south of Lebanon, which is one of the harshest refugee camps. The family, there are 2 brothers and the wife of one of the 2 brothers who are in their late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, they're people who have endured the suffering of the Palestinian people throughout the past, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
They were expelled from Palestine in 1948. They went to a refugee camp in Lebanon. During the civil war in Lebanon, they had to leave different refugee camps, flee different areas in Lebanon. So they've basically lived as homeless refugees for the majority of their life. And now they come here to Canada and apply for refugee status. They get rejected. And mm-hmm. yet again, they're facing with the same problem of being deported back.
Yeah.
Refugee camps in Lebanon. So they had to take the hard decision of taking a refuge in a church, and
oh.
they've had a lot of support from the church community, from the community at large.
Although recently the Canadian government really showed its insensitivity and immorality by really raiding the churches and not respecting the sanctity of the church by deporting Muhammad Sharfi to Algeria, to the States. He's Algerian, who was deported to the States. So I won't advise them to stay in the church if they want to stay underground. What do you think?
Well, I mean, obviously, we saw the case of Muhammad Sharfi, which outraged most people here, and it outraged a lot of the church community. 15 police officers storming into the church and taking Muhammad Sharfi and deporting him to the United States in less than 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Without any form of due process whatsoever. And Muhammad Sharfi is still in jail after more than 2-3 months now in the United States, without knowing exactly what will happen to him. So obviously there is this fear that, with the climate that exists right now, there's not even any respect for sanctuary inside churches. And this is quite amazing to see, this happening here in Canada. So on one end, yes, it's true, the fear is there. And the mistreatment is clear, and it's there, and it's persistent.
Yeah, even.
However, on the other hand, some people simply have no choices. For example, this family, they're in their late 60s. So they had, if they stayed outside the church, there's also the difficulty of trying to survive without any access to public services.
Yeah.
Healthcare, social welfare, or anything else.
Yeah.
With regards to other young, Palestinians who are younger, they're more able to sustain themselves living underground. you know, because they're younger, you know, they don't have people mm-hmm. who are dependent on them, other than the fact that obviously they, you know, yeah. their families back in the refugee camps depend on them for support also.
Yeah.
So on one hand, it's true that there is this danger, but on the other hand, people are not left with much choice.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully the sanctuary will still be respected.
Yeah, I hope so, because even dictators and fascists respect the churches and their sanctity. But I'd like to move a bit also to the Canadian government. You know, Canada was responsible for the basically the dispossession of the Palestinian people because of their support for the partition plan, their active support, actually. Pearson played a major role in the partition plan. So Canada really carries a major responsibility in the what they call the refugee problem. And really it's a problem for them, not for the Palestinian people. But, you know, John Manley, a couple of years ago, declared that he's, when he was a foreign minister, he declared that he's going to accept tens of thousands of refugees, of Palestinian refugees. Why do you think the Canadian government not acting on this promise? And was it politically motivated when he announced that, to support Israel rather than to support Palestinian refugees?
Yeah, well, first, I definitely agree that Canada and many other countries, Western countries and other countries, have participated directly in the dispossession of the Palestinian people and have helped, you know, entirely create the problem of the Palestinian refugees, the existence of the Palestinian refugees, and, you know, the permanence of the refugee camps in the Middle East. Well, you know, and the Palestinian refugees in these refugee camps have been used as political cards by the West, by Israel, and by the Arab regimes, by the corrupt Arab regimes. They have always been used as political cards and not treated as human beings. So definitely Canada has a direct responsibility, like the entire international community, with regards to the Palestinian refugees. Now, in terms of what John Manley has stated, as you said, obviously there's a huge hypocrisy there. The Palestinian people are not asking, we are not asking for our people to be transferred en masse into the diaspora, as they're already in the diaspora. What we are asking is for our rights to be respected as human beings, mm-hmm. our basic civil and human rights to be respected wherever we are, and also part of those rights is the inalienable right to return to our homeland, which is Palestine.
Yeah.
So the politic of Manley asking for, you know, accepting tens and thousands of refugees is in line with the Zionist plan, with the Israeli policy of transferring Palestinians as far away as possible from Palestine and taking away their identity. And this is something, regardless of what Canada states or any other country states or does, cannot happen, because it's the Palestinian people who will always be fighting for their right of return and for their right. And nobody can take away our identity. But what we are asking here, we're not asking Canada to participate in the transfer of Palestinians. We're asking Canada to respect its own international obligations. The fact of the matter is, the conditions in the refugee camps and in the West Bank and Gaza Strip make it that, you know, refugees are fleeing those areas and coming here. Mm-hmm. And there's dangers to their lives and to their dignity and to their mm-hmm. basic rights if they're sent back there.
Yeah.
So what we're asking is for Canada to respect its international obligations and not deport people back.
And
they're going to be persecuted.
Yeah.
But
and
we're not asking for Canada to participate yeah. in the transfer
yeah.
and the denial of the right of return of the Palestinian refugees.
Yeah. Actually, we are really running out of time. Rabia, we really thank you for being with us. And we thank you for all the efforts you are doing on behalf of the refugees, coupled with explaining why there is a so-called refugee problem to the Canadian public. And keep up the good work, and we hope to talk to you soon. And thank you very much, and have a good night.
Thank you.
That was Rabia Al-Masri from the Coalition Against the Deportation of Palestinian Refugees.
للوطن هبوا للنضالين يرجع للوطن حبه للنضالين ثوروا مع الأحرار على الطغيان يا با.
And we were listening to a short piece of music by the in the name of freedom. Actually, it's by a Palestinian group called Al Amal Al Sha'bi. We regret that we don't have time for the piece of music, so we'll go right to focus on Zionism. Marion?
Tonight's focus is actually a follow-up, a sequel to the focus that we had last week about the Palestinian boy who was used as a human shield. Tonight's focus is a dispatch from Reuters, April 24th. This is the highlights of it. A photograph of a Palestinian boy tied to an Israeli police jeep has been handed over to Israeli justice officials charged with investigating complaints over the use of human shields against demonstrators. The boy, 13-year-old Mohammed Bedouin, and three adult protesters were tied to border police vehicles last week during one of what have become almost daily demonstrations against the routing of the Israeli government's barrier through Palestinian land. Rabbi Eric Asherman, who heads the organization Rabbis for Human Rights, said the danger was that the inquiry would treat the case as an isolated incident, which he said it was not. He also wanted the inquiry to examine whether such tactics were an inevitable consequence of the pressure cooker atmosphere created by the occupation of Palestinian territories. And just before we go to our last music break, we'd like to just remind listeners one more time. This week we are part of Co-op Radio's Spring Marathon. Tonight we're part of a special day and night of programming entitled Celebrating Resistance. And we urge all listeners to call in and pledge a membership or renew an old membership, take out a special donation to help support the show, to help support the station. It depends mostly on membership donations, which are tax deductible. So please call now, 604-684-8494, and help keep shows like Voice of Palestine on the airwaves. That's 604-684-8494.
Again, that was a short piece by Lebanese singer Marcel Khalife and the anthem of the Intifada. We have few announcements, Marion?
Yes, there's many events coming up in May, but we'll save some of them for next week's announcements. We just want to focus on the ones coming up in the next few days and in the next week. First of all, on Thursday, April 29th, that's in just 2 days, at 7:30 p.m., there'll be a meeting held at the Unitarian Church, 949 West 49th at Oak Street. It's a two-part meeting. First of all, there'll be a new documentary shown from Jean Pilger, Breaking the Silence, Truth and Lies in the War on Terror. And then there'll be a report back from Baghdad by Riyad Musleh. Riyad's the former editor of Shirouk. And he's been a guest here on Voice of Palestine, and he just returned back from a month-long visit to Baghdad, and we'll talk about his experiences. That's this Thursday, April 29th, 7:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Church, 949 West 49th and Oak. And then there's lots of MayWorks events coming up. The one we wanted to tell you about in specific is a workshop being put on by the International Solidarity Movement Vancouver this Saturday, May 1st, from 12:30 to 2 p.m. at the Wise Hall, 1882 Victoria on Adanac Street. There'll be a workshop, Solidarity Against the Occupation. As I said, that's put on by ISM Vancouver. And, of course, there's lots of other MayWorks events going on. People can grab their brochures at all sorts of outlets around town. Back to you, Hanna.
And with that, we conclude another edition of The Voice of Palestine. Our production crew for tonight has been Pat Newton and Marion Kawas. Our final piece of music is by Palestinian folk singers Fajr al-Hurriye, The Dawn of Freedom Troop. The only solution is the return of Palestine and the return of its people to it. We dedicate this song to all the Arab people who are struggling against Israeli and U.S. occupations and their proxies, from Morocco to Kuwait. These proxies are puppets for the U.S. and the Western governments. We are also celebrating their resistance, the Arab people resistance to the Israel and to the U.S. empire supported by its Western allies, including the Canadian government. Please stay tuned for the World Poetry Show coming up next on Vancouver Cooperative Radio 102.7 FM. We really would like to thank all those, and many have already phoned and pledged their support for the station and for the Voice of Palestine. We thank them, and we pledge to them to continue the Voice of Palestine. If you haven't already done and phoned, please remember to call after the show at 604-684-8494 and pledge your support to keep this show and Co-op Radio on the air. I've been your host, Hanna Kawas, for the Voice of Palestine. Have a good night.
Here,